something?
It's just a recorder.
Okay, so thanks for the invitation. It's nice to be back in BU. I guess usually I'm in the physics department when I come here. Like she said, please ask questions throughout because, things will build on other things and, if it's confusing, it's okay to, I guess we have extra time anyways since dinner is until 5:30. So. Okay, so yeah, my title is a little different than what I sent before, so I was going to talk about Noether's theorems in field theory and quantum gravity. And there will be a bit of overlap with some of the earlier talks that we heard this afternoon. So in discussions of symmetry, people actually, so this is just the same thing that we heard in the first talk. So often we just talk about Noether's theorem, but actually if you look at Noether's paper, there's two Noether's theorems. So the first one, which is the one that people usually mean, says that if you have a Lagrangian field theory with a continuous global symmetry, then there's a conserved local current. So that's the sort of the famous Noether's theorem. But then she also has this theorem where she says that given any Lagrangian field theory with a continuous local symmetry, there is a differential relation between the equations of motion. And actually, I would say both of these theorems are really essential in modern physics. And even now, we're still improving our understanding of what these theorems really mean. And so quite a bit of what I'll talk about today is fairly recent work. So I'll talk about what I think they mean and on some of these recent developments. So let's start with the first one. So what does it mean for Lagrangian field theory, say that has some Lagrangian, which can depend on a position and also on some fields and their derivatives and maybe their second derivatives and maybe their third derivatives, but probably not their infinitely many derivatives. So what does it mean for such a Lagrangian to have a continuous global symmetry? Well, what it means is that there's an infinitesimal redefinition of the coordinates and fields, meaning I can take the coordinate x mu and shift it by some function, some fixed function depending on x times the infinitesimal parameter epsilon, and I can also shift the fields by some other function which depends on the coordinates, also on the fields and its derivatives. And actually, in principle, I could allow this one to depend on the fields too, although in practice we rarely do that. And then the idea is that we want the action, which is the integral of the Lagrangian density, to be invariant. So if we stick the transform coordinates and the transform fields under the action, and we also transform the measure of integration, then if we change back to the original coordinates and undo the transformation, then we get the same action that we had before. Okay. And now I want to emphasize that this f and this psi are fixed functions of the indicated arguments. And epsilon is an infinitesimal parameter which is independent of x, and that's the key thing in this word global here. Okay, it's saying that this parameter that parametrizes the symmetry transformation is independent of where you are in space-time. So we have no freedom to, do the symmetry in one place but not do the symmetry in another place. If we do it with parameter epsilon, then we have to do it everywhere with parameter epsilon. That's why we call it global. Okay. So, for example, we could be talking about the spins in a magnet, and then there can be a continuous global symmetry where you just rotate all the spins by 45 degrees, and that's what's going on here. And at least in some magnets, the dynamics of the magnet is invariant under that. If you rotate and then evolve, you get the same thing as if you had evolved and then rotated. Okay. Which is basically the same as saying that the action is invariant. And then what Noether's first theorem tells us is that given any such symmetry, there's going to be a current function, which is a vector, which depends on position and also on the fields and their derivatives, where the fields and derivatives are all also evaluated at the point x, so it just depends on stuff at point x, such that this vector is conserved, its divergence is zero. And so more practically, what that means is that there's a charge density which you can measure locally, and which is kind of transported around from here to there without being destroyed. So if you have the charge here, And then a little bit later, you don't have the charge here. It had to have moved away from here in some way that respects locality. And that's what this equation tells you. Okay, so that's Noether's first theorem. Now, usually if you take a continuous global symmetry and then you say, okay, now I'm going to allow epsilon to be position dependent, right? That I could do that, right? I could go to this formula. I could say, okay, let's just allow epsilon to be position dependent. But usually when you do that, what happens is that the action will no longer be invariant, and so it won't be a symmetry. So for example, in the magnet, if you rotated just the spins here and not the spins there, that wouldn't leave the action invariant. But every now and then, the action still is invariant if you allow epsilon to depend on position. And if that's true, then we say that the theory has a continuous local symmetry, where now you can choose to do the symmetry here and not do the symmetry here, or do it here by this much and do it there by that much. And still the action is invariant under that. So the canonical example of this is Maxwell's theory of electromagnetism, which in modern notation has a Lagrangian which looks like this. So F mu nu is a 4x4 matrix, which is an anti-symmetric matrix. It's basically made out of the electric and magnetic fields, but this is grouping them together to make the equation simpler. And then this F we view as being written in terms of the gauge potential A. So the zero component of A is the electrostatic potential you learn about in high school, and then the vector component of A is the magnetic vector potential you might learn is the curl is the magnetic field. Okay. So this equation combines the statement that the gradient of the scalar potential is the electric field, and the curl of the vector potential is the magnetic field. But since it's annoying to say that every time, we have this condensed notation to express it this way. Okay, and then the nice thing about that's very manifest when you write, continuous. This Lagrangian is invariant under a continuous local symmetry where I just take this vector potential A mu, and I shift it by the derivative of an arbitrary function. Okay. And so it's easy to see that it's invariant, right? Because if you take this and you plug it into this equation, you see here I'm going to get d mu d nu epsilon, and here I'm going to get d nu d mu epsilon. And since partial derivatives commute, the transformation is going to cancel between these two terms. So this f is invariant under the symmetry, and since f is all that appears in the Lagrangian is going to be invariant under the symmetry too, and so therefore will be the action. So, okay, what does Noether say about this? Well, what Noether's second theorem tells us is that if there's a continuous local symmetry like this, then there's also going to be a relationship between the equations of motion which you get by varying the action. So for example, in Maxwell theory, the equations of motion, so these are Maxwell's equations, again using modern notation, is that d mu f mu nu is zero. And so if you look at this equation, it looks like four independent equations, because this mu index is contracted, but there's this nu index. And this nu index could be time, or it could be x, or it could be y, or it could be z. So that looks like four equations of motion. And that's good because, we started with this, the field is A mu, and there are four components of A mu, so it sounds like there's four equations of motion for four degrees of freedom. But actually that's wrong, because if you look at this equation, if I take the derivative of it with respect to d nu and then contract it, okay, then this is true for any A mu, whether or not it obeys the equation of motion. Because remember, this f mu nu was anti-symmetric, and again, these partial derivatives are commuting, and so this is just zero. And so what that means is there aren't actually enough equations of motion to determine the equation, the dynamics of A mu, and that was also mentioned in the first talk. So for example, think about in Maxwell's equations, right? So say A mu obeys Maxwell's equations. I can add to it d mu epsilon to get another solution of Maxwell's equations. And I can choose epsilon however I like. So in particular, I can choose epsilon to be zero now and for the next 50 years, but then not be zero, okay? And that changes, you know, then all the initial conditions now are the same, but the solution later is different, okay? But I mean, come on, right? Like being able to predict the future given the present, that's what we do in physics, right? Like that's our job. That's what they pay us to do. Not very well sometimes. So what are we supposed to make of a theory where we can't do this? Where given the future, given the present, we can't predict the future, right? That's what Noether's second theorem says, is in a theory with a local symmetry, given the present, you can't predict the future. So one possibility, which may sound tempting, is you just say, okay, well, that's ridiculous, so we just shouldn't think about theories that have local symmetries. Okay. But actually, right, like most of physics, for example, electromagnetism, as we just discussed, is based on theories that do have local symmetries, so probably this isn't the right philosophy. Or maybe I shouldn't use the word philosophy here so cavalierly. So actually, there is a way to kind of salvage the situation. So what we do is we say that we view these local symmetries as gauge symmetries. And what that means is that we say that any two configurations which are related by a gauge symmetry are actually physically identical. They're physically indistinguishable, and we should just think of them as being the same, you know, state of the system. And then once you do this, you don't worry about this ambiguity, because you're just describing the same thing in different ways, and that's fine. It's not a different thing. So for example, in electromagnetism, A mu and A mu plus partial mu epsilon lead to the same field strength tensor F mu nu, which, as I mentioned, is in old-fashioned notation is the electric and magnetic fields. And so classically, these electric and magnetic fields are the only things we can measure anyway, so who cares if this A mu has this ambiguity? Now, quantum mechanically, there are a few more things we can measure, which are gauge invariant non-local integrals of A. And I'll come back to that later in the talk. Okay. So in other words, what Noether's second theorem tells us is that we're allowed to consider theories with local symmetries, but only if we view those symmetries as sort of mere redundancies of description. They're not real things. They're just sort of... you know, you adding extra stuff that you didn't need, and then you have to remember you didn't need it and take it back. Okay. And then functions of the fields, well, clearly they'd better not depend on... Yeah, sure.
Does Noether's theorem give you that?
Noether's second theorem says that. Yeah, because Noether's second theorem exactly tells us that there's going to be this relation, kind of relation between the equations of motion, so we can't predict the future for A mu. And so if we still want to have physics be deterministic, we have to do something, right? And so, right, so Noether's theorem is telling us that if we don't identify these configurations, it's not going to be good physics. You know, it's going to be you can get whatever you want in the future, you know, kind of physics, which of course would be very useful, but it doesn't seem to be how things work. Okay. So then functions of the fields, well, so it's fine to try to take this philosophy, but then there's a new rule, right, which is that anything that we can actually measure had better be gauge invariant. It had better not care about whether or not we do this transformation, because if it cares, and we're saying that this transformation is unphysical, then the thing we're talking about is also unphysical. So it means that the only things that have physical meaning are A mu itself has no physical meaning. Only functions of A mu, which are independent of whether you do A mu or you do A mu plus D mu epsilon, are physical and can actually be measured. Okay. And so, you see, the physics of global and local symmetries are really quite different. So for example, just to give one physics example, so in condensed matter physics, which is not what I do, but anyways, I'll use the example from there, superfluids are explained in terms of the breaking of a U1 global symmetry, while superconductors are explained in terms of the breaking of a U1 local symmetry. And the physics is totally different. In the lab, if you have a superconductor, and if you have a lab, well, I wouldn't because I'm a theorist, but you know, if I had a superfluid, you know, it would be very easy to tell them apart. They're just totally qualitatively different. Yeah?
But superconductors involve electrons.
Yeah.
And electrons are not coming out of Maxwell's equation.
So I just used Maxwell as the simplest example, but as was done in the previous talk, I could certainly add matter which is charged. So I could add electrons, or I could add charged scalar matter, and there would still be the symmetry, and everything that I said is still true. Yeah, Maxwell's theory here was just an example, right? So Noether's theorem is very general, as someone, I think he was emphasizing in his talk, right? I mean, you know, it applies very generally, and in particular, if you add some electrons or something, it still fits within the framework of Noether's first and second theorem.
But the J is totally different. FIJ as the Lorentz equation?
Yeah, so the redundancy isn't quite as simple as this if you add them, but there's still a redundancy. So remember, if you add the... to be simple, let's make it a scalar like what was done in the previous talk.
Okay, I understand that.
If I add a charge scalar, there's now a new equation of motion as well. And so the relation involves, it's not just an identity on Maxwell's equations, it's an identity on Maxwell's equations together with the equations of the scalar. But there's still some identity, and so we still need to do this redundancy. Okay. All right. So that's just kind of a review of how a physicist today thinks about Noether's two theorems. Now, there have been several developments related to this in the last few years, and I guess, yeah, I'm here because I've been involved in some of them, so I'll just sketch a few of them now. So the first is that actually there's a sense in which Noether's second theorem can lead to counterexamples to Noether's first theorem. Now, of course, Noether's first theorem is a theorem, so it's as stated, it's not going to have counterexamples, so that's why I say in a sense. So here's what I mean by in a sense. So the loophole is that if we have a theory with both a global and a local symmetry, so Noether's first theorem tells us that there'll be a current for the global symmetry. But it doesn't tell us that the current will be invariant under the local symmetry. And so if it isn't, then Noether's second theorem tells us that we can't view that current as physical because it's not gauge invariant. And actually there was an example of that in the previous... Well, no, actually, sorry, let me not say that. But okay, I'll give an example in a sec. So then Noether's first theorem would give you a current, but it would be a current which is useless. It would be a current you can't measure. And this actually happens. So here's an example. You can just look at a theory with now not one, but two Maxwell fields, A and A tilde. So then there's a continuous symmetry which rotates A and A tilde and therefore F and F tilde into each other, just one to the other. But if you write out the Noether current associated to that, which is a trivial exercise, it depends explicitly on A mu and A tilde mu. It doesn't just depend on F, and in fact it's not gauge invariant. And there's no way of improving it to make it gauge invariant. There's a fancier example, which I mentioned because it happens in the real world, in the standard model of particle physics, where the gauge non-invariance of the Noether current for a certain approximate global symmetry, which is called chiral symmetry in quantum chromodynamics, leads to what's viewed as a surprisingly large decay rate for the neutral pion into two photons. So I cited me because I explained it in terms of the Noether current, but the idea that this decay rate is faster than expected goes back to the 1950s. I would say it's only recently that it's been understood that the reason it's allowed is because there's a so-called counterexample to Noether's theorem.
So the first example, does that have anything to do with physics?
What's your definition of physics?
It describes something in the real world.
Well, in the real world, there's not two photons. So certainly it's not realistic from the point of view of particle physics.
Okay.
We could try to engineer a condensed matter system where it had two photons, and there are examples of that.
So what do you think you would say that?
What do you mean?
How would you...
Well, you can often have emergent gauge fields in condensed matter physics, for example, in the fractional quantum Hall system. And so then in the fractional quantum Hall system...
Oh, okay.
And so then in the fractional quantum Hall system, there's a emergent gauge field, and then there's the electromagnetic gauge field, and that's two gauge fields. Now, that particular system is not going to have this symmetry, but I could imagine trying to come up with some other system that has it. I'm not sure.
Okay. Yeah.
But this, anyways, Noether is a mathematician, and I'm just discussing, we're just discussing, is the theorem true as a statement about Lagrangians?
Okay.
But this one is the real world. Well, if you want, I can write down the standard model of Lagrangian. There's a whiteboard here. We can spend 20 minutes. Okay. Now, other interesting developments have come from trying to understand, in what sense gauge symmetries still have some physical content, despite the fact that they're only redundancies. And that's kind of the puzzle. So it's been understood for a while that a gauge symmetry is only a redundancy of description. And nonetheless, we use them all the time. And you might wonder, how can something which is a mere redundancy of description be useful? Right? Why is it that in theoretical physics we do this thing all the time, you know, if it doesn't mean anything? Right? And so people have been trying to understand, you know, is there some other way of thinking about it where you can focus in a more precise way on the physically meaningful consequences of having engaged symmetry? So recently there's sort of been two popular ways of trying to do this. So the first is that you organize the discussion around these non-local integrals of A, which I mentioned earlier, which are called Wilson lines. So the simplest kind of Wilson line is you have a loop in space, and then the gauge field is a vector, and you just integrate the vector around the loop in space. And it turns out that that's gauge invariant, because when you shift A by d mu epsilon, you're integrating epsilon, the derivative of something around a circle. And so then as long as the thing is single valued, you're going to get zero, and so then you're going to get the same value whether or not you do the gauge transformation. Okay, and so people have, there's this interesting idea of symmetries which act on lines instead. So far in Noether's theorem, Noether is always thinking about symmetries that act on local operators. You know, it sends a field here to a field here. But now there's a new kind of symmetry, which is called a one-form symmetry, which is a symmetry that acts on lines instead of points. And often, gauge theories have these one-form global symmetries. And since these are global symmetries and not gauge symmetries, they're real.
So when you say lines, you mean curves?
Yeah, it could be. Yeah. A curve in space-time. Okay. So that's one philosophy. This one is very nice when it works, but unfortunately it doesn't always work. So for example, in QCD with fundamental quarks, there's no one-form symmetry. And so if you want to make sense of it, that's not the right way to do it. There's a second approach which works more generally, where the idea is to note that Noether's second theorem, it's true kind of in the interior of space-time, but if space-time has a boundary, then it's actually not true. And you can try to use this to give physical meaning to gauge symmetry. For me, the second approach is the one that's more interesting, at least for this talk, so I'll talk about it. So the key point is that if you look at the proof of Noether's second theorem, it doesn't actually require you to treat the boundary part of a local symmetry as a gauge symmetry. For example, if you have an epsilon which approaches a non-zero constant at infinity, you don't need to view that as a redundancy. You can instead view it as a physical symmetry. But what it does is it acts on charge operators which have one of these Wilson lines attaching them to infinity. So in electromagnetism, we like to think of that by saying that the symmetry is generated by the electric flux at infinity. You can take the integral of the normal electric field through a sphere that's very large. And that's something that, if you act on that, you know, act with that on states, they'll transform if they carry electric charge. And here, what carrying electric charge means is exactly that, you know. If you just have the electron by itself there, it's not gauge invariant, so it's not physical. So if you want to have talk about electrons as physical things, you have to talk about creating an electron together with creating the electric field that carries its charge out to infinity, which is what this Wilson line does. And once you've done that, that's gauge invariant. That's what we really mean by an electron. We mean an electron plus its electric field. An electron plus its electric field does transform under this gauge symmetry that acts at infinity, because the Wilson line makes it all the way out to infinity, and so the symmetry can detect it. So this kind of symmetry is sometimes called an asymptotic symmetry, since it only acts on the endpoints of lines that make it to infinity, and it doesn't do anything in the interior of space. So it's a kind of symmetry that's real, but it's quite different from a global symmetry in the traditional Noetherian sense. Because, you know, like with the magnet or something, you know, that does something on the spin sitting right here in the center. You don't have to talk about going out to infinity to find something that transforms under the symmetry. Now, Hiroshi Iguri and I imposed an additional requirement on these symmetries, which is that we said that there have to be finite energy states, it has to be possible for there to be finite energy states which transform under the symmetry. And this is precisely designed to rule out what we discussed in the last talk, which is that, for example, in QCD, color charge is confined. So it's impossible to have a finite energy state which is charged under color. So you could try to talk about these asymptotic symmetries, but they would be very boring. Everything would be neutral. Okay. So to have interesting asymptotic symmetries, you want to allow states which are charged and also have finite energy. And so with that requirement, then we called it a long-range gauge symmetry. Okay. And that's a real thing. That's a sort of physical consequence of a gauge symmetry. Yes? Yeah, so good. So a Wilson loop is always gauge invariant. If you have an asymptotic boundary, you can also have a Wilson line which goes to infinity. Because since you're not quotienting by gauge transformations that are non-trivial at infinity, the endpoint of the Wilson line is gauge invariant if it's at infinity. So that there are two kinds of endpoints of Wilson lines that are allowed. You can have an endpoint at infinity, and you can have an endpoint on a field that's charged. So if you take, for example, in your setting, you can have a Wilson line that you integrate to a finite point in space, and then I can stick your phi field there. And then what happens is if I do a gauge transformation, the phi field transforms, but the Wilson line transforms in the opposite way, and so it's invariant. So that's what's going on at this endpoint. What's going on at this endpoint is that the symmetry is not a local symmetry at the endpoint, at the infinity, so I don't have to have things be gauge invariant under it.
So that confuses me. So far, it seems like I could think of the symmetry precisely the same way as epsilon as a function in space-time, and it just happens to be really restricted.
Good. So I guess somebody here mentioned cohomology, so maybe not. It was you, I guess. Yeah. So the right statement is that the full set of gauge transformations are allowed to depend on space, but then you quotient by the ones which go to zero at infinity. So the asymptotic symmetry group is this is like sort of the cohomology. You identify by the things that go to zero at infinity. I shouldn't call it cohomology. I should just call it a quotient. Yeah, I should just call it a quotient. So you're kind of taking an infinite dimensional group and quotienting it by an infinite dimensional normal subgroup. And then what you're left with is a finite dimensional Lie group, if that helps. Okay, so that was what I wanted to say about sort of just Noether's theorems in sort of general quantum field theory. Now let's get to the last part of the talk, which is about quantum gravity, just to keep piling on. So Noether's theorems also have interesting applications for quantum gravity. So I'll explain that now. In our best understood theory of quantum gravity, which maybe you heard about sometime, which is this ADS-CFT correspondence. So what the ADS-CFT correspondence says is that if you have quantum gravity in asymptotically anti-de Sitter space, which for the purposes of this talk you should think of as gravity in a can of soup. So here's the can of soup, and the gravity is happening in the soup. So there's a radial direction, and then there's time going up, because time always goes up. And then there's an angular direction going around. And g is not equal to zero. So this is us sitting in the center. And it's gravity in so-called asymptotically ADS space. So it's gravity where the cosmological constant is negative. That's a bit embarrassing, because in our world, the cosmological constant is positive. But what can I say? You know, it's a lamppost thing. This is easier to think about, so we think about this. So then the idea is that quantum gravity here, which is something which is a very confusing thing, you know, there could be black holes in here, Hawking radiation and everything. The idea is that that's actually equivalent quantum mechanically to just having an ordinary quantum field theory living on the boundary of the soup. So just living in the can. So it's like saying the soup is dual to the can. So in the can there's no gravity. And that's good because well, other than gravity, we understand quantum field theory. You know, gravity is the thing that's confusing. So if you don't have gravity, then quantum field theory is a pretty good thing. Now, I say that as a physicist, right? A mathematician would say we don't understand quantum field theory at all. But okay, well, that's true at their level of rigor. And that's great because it takes something we don't understand and says it's equal to something that we do understand, and that's called progress. Now, for this talk, we don't need to know much about this correspondence. You just have this can picture in mind and remember that time goes up. But I do want to tell you a few other things. So, So, well, it's a quantum correspondence, so you can think about states. So since time goes up, this disk here is a time slice of the bulk theory. So the ADS theory is usually called the bulk theory because it's living in the interior. And this is called the boundary theory because it lives in the boundary. So a state on a time slice of this is supposed to correspond to a state on a time slice of this, which is just this circle. Okay, it's isomorphism between the Hilbert spaces, right? So every state in the quantum gravity theory corresponds to a state in the boundary conformal field theory and vice versa. So as quantum mechanical systems, they're really the same. Now, of course, that doesn't help unless I tell you what the isomorphism is. I have to tell you which state corresponds to which state. And actually, it's easier if instead of doing that, I tell you which operator corresponds to which operator. And then surely if I've done that, then you can figure out for yourself about the states. And there's a standard rule, which is that in this bulk theory, you can take any field in the bulk, which, see, it depends on all three of these coordinates, the radial direction and time and the angular direction on the boundary, and then I extrapolate it to the boundary. I take the limit r going to infinity. And then the rule is that once I've done that, I get an operator in the boundary quantum field theory, which is a local operator. It's an operator just lives at the point that I extrapolated to. So it's very natural, right? You know, you have some field here, maybe it's complicated, but then you extrapolate to the boundary and it looks simple. By the way, maybe I should just mention, right, so the Escher here is scientifically accurate. So because of the negative curvature, this is what the space looks like. Okay. At least near the vacuum, of course. If I have some huge black hole or something there, it gets all distorted and the fish get eaten by the black hole.
Wait, how do you go back? You went one way.
Yeah.
Left to right, and how do you go right to left?
Well, yeah, I guess I had the arrows going both ways, right? But so indeed, you could ask, what about fields in the center that I didn't take to the boundary? Is that what you're asking about?
Or if I'm on the boundary there, how do I go back to inside?
Well, yeah, so any local operator here, I can sort of interpret as the limit of something in the bulk. The something might be complicated. It might be something that creates a black hole, so it might not be a simple thing. But every local operator on the boundary is a limit of something in the bulk. Indeed, it's a little bit more subtle to think about if you have something right in the center here, how do you think about that in the boundary theory?
Is this a one-to-one correspondence?
Yes.
So it would seem like anything on the ray out to the boundary is set to the same point on the boundary. It would seem that any point inside, there's many points inside that go to that same point on the boundary.
Yeah, that's right. But no, the equation holds after I take the limit. I'm not saying it holds before you take the limit. That's an additional question, is what if I study this at finite r and I don't take the limit?
Then
depending on r, I should get something different over here.
Yeah, seems like it's hard to go backwards because it's defined in terms of the limit.
Right. So that's what I'm saying. So I agree with that. And so that's my day job. So we understand quite a bit about that, but I don't think I can explain it in this talk unless you want to have another longer discussion.
Okay.
Yeah, quite a bit is understood about that. But this is kind of the simplest. So we say there's a dictionary between the two. This is the simplest line in the dictionary. Okay, so good. Now let's get back to Noether. So what do Noether's theorems tell us about this correspondence? What they tell us is that if you have a global symmetry in the boundary CFT, then you have one of these what I call long-range gauge symmetries in the bulk ADS. So let's see how it works. So first, let's say that there's a continuous global symmetry in the boundary CFT. So by Noether's first theorem, there's a Noether current. By the dictionary I just described, this current is the boundary limit of a dynamical field in the bulk. And by using the conservation of the current, you can show that it's going to be a gauge field. And so therefore, there's a local symmetry in the bulk. Conversely, see, I even wrote converse on the slide. Say that there's a long-range gauge symmetry in the bulk. By Noether's second theorem, only the gauge transformations which approach a non-zero constant at infinity are physical. The rest are just redundancies of description. The ones that are non-trivial at the boundary act on the endpoints of Wilson lines, as we discussed, But if we extrapolate the interior pieces of the Wilson lines to the boundary, then they just become local operators on the boundary. And so this asymptotic symmetry in the bulk becomes something that just acts on local operators in the boundary and is therefore a global symmetry. This is a bit sketchy. One can, of course, give precise definitions and make this sound more rigorous. So, but for this talk, we can say it in a more fanciful way. We can just say that Noether's first theorem in the boundary is dual to Noether's second theorem in the bulk. Now, there are various questions which may occur to you which aren't quite captured by Noether's theorem. And these are things that in this paper with Hiroshi we thought about. So for example, you might say, okay, well that told me what happens if there's a gauge symmetry, if there's a local symmetry in the bulk, but what if there's a global symmetry in the bulk? What is that in the boundary CFT? Well, the answer is that it's nothing because there aren't any global symmetries in quantum gravity. So that's an old conjecture that goes back to Wheeler. Evidence is gradually accumulated over the decades. And Hiroshi and I were actually able to give a proof within the ADS CFT correspondence that were you to have a global symmetry in the bulk, it would lead to an inconsistency in the boundary conformal field theory. So you just can't have one. Which potentially has interesting phenomenological applications, although we're quite far from understanding that in a useful way. You could also ask, okay, let's try the other thing. Say we have a local symmetry in the boundary, what's that dual to? Well, again, the answer is nothing, and here we do use cohomology. So the boundary of a boundary is zero. I guess that's homology. So there can't be any long-range gauge symmetry in the boundary, because there's no boundary of the boundary. And remember that when we wanted to give physical content to gauge theory, we did it by introducing a boundary. So you can have local symmetries in the boundary if you want to, but they're just mere redundancies of description, and they mean nothing. And since they mean nothing, they may also mean nothing in the bulk. You could also ask, do analogous statements hold for discrete symmetries? So Noether's theorems, as we've been discussing today, are all about continuous symmetries. In the language of the last talk, they're about Lie groups which have dimension greater than zero. But you could also ask, what about a Z2 symmetry? Just the reflection symmetry, or what about parity, or something like that, symmetries that aren't part of continuous Lie groups. Well, Noether's theorem doesn't say anything about that, but actually the analogous statements do hold. And to see that, you need to work out analogs of Noether's theorems for discrete symmetries. Typos everywhere, discrete symmetries, which we did. So here we are, 100 years after Noether, and still she's teaching us. And not just this stuff. I mean, as was mentioned in one of the other talks, of course, her work in abstract mathematics also is, very influential in mathematics, but also in physics. I mean, for example, representation theory is something which Noether made great contributions to. All right, that's it for me. Thanks.
Could you say something about the global symmetry on the boundary?
You just mean like what it is?
It
depends a bit what example you're talking about, but I think you can think about it like this thing with the magnet. You have a bunch of spins or something, and then there's a symmetry that just rotates all the spins.
Well, in conformal field theory, especially in two dimensions,
yeah,
you have an infinite.
Yeah, that's true. So that's a subtlety that I suppressed here. So that has to do with how we define global symmetries. So in the statements that I make, I define a global symmetry as something that commutes with the energy momentum tensor. And so that throws out the higher Katz-Moody currents. And we only talk about the zero mode currents, which are the ones that commute with the stress tensor. And so for each gauge symmetry in the bulk, there will be one of those, but there will be many. For each gauge field in the bulk, there will be one of those zero mode symmetries, but as you say, there will also be a whole tower of Katz-Moody symmetries. But I'll just view that all as one global symmetry.
Can I ask, I'm kind of thinking about if there's any relationship between the bulk and boundary in terms that we think about when we're deriving Noether's theorems and this bulk and boundary that you're talking about? So when we derive notice theorem,
yeah,
then we retain, we do a variation that includes the endpoint, so we keep the bulk and boundary term. Effectively, the first theorem is setting the bulk term equal to boundary term.
Yeah.
Then we derive our second theorem, we throw away all the boundary terms, and that's how you get the second theorem.
Yeah.
And applying it, his thing he did in 1918 was
yeah.
to throw away the interior terms and just keep the boundary terms, then you get this sort of set of equations for things that have to hold.
Yeah, so we'll.
Boundary is that?
There is some relationship. So in particular, my statement that Noether's second theorem doesn't hold right at the boundary is related to these boundary terms. So it's basically because you can't do this business of throwing away that thing right at the boundary. Yeah, yeah. So that's absolutely true from the bulk point of view, and that's what enables you to have non-trivial asymptotic symmetries. Now in the boundary theory where we're just talking about a global symmetry, I think what I would say is that there the boundary terms are kind of more superfluous. I mean, yeah, they show up in Noether's original derivation, but if you do it in a slightly more elegant way, then they're not there. So the argument for the current is kind of more general. I don't know. It doesn't really require. I mean, of course, the way she did the proof, she needed to do that. But if you do the proof in a different way, you don't need to think about that. Yeah. Okay. Sure, sure.
Are you familiar with these equations that Quine derived? I think, I forget who it is, someone calls them cascade equations or something like this, things you can derive for us to hold on the boundary for local symmetries.
Well, not in the historical way that you said it, but probably I know it. If you write them for me, I probably know the equations. But yeah, I don't know the history very well, I'm sorry. No.
He holds on to all boundary terms, which is only second term, the boundary terms. So all of these are the set of conditions then that will have to hold for your fields because it's holding on to boundary considerations.
Oh, yeah.
And later on, somebody does a much more deep mess.
Yeah.
And get calls from cascade equations, and I never saw what happened to them or whether they got.
I mean, being careful about boundary terms is like what I spend half of my time doing. So yeah, there's a lot of stuff about boundary terms. Noether, I think because she, because she wasn't thinking about physics, right? So so she didn't state the theorem in the way that precisely in the way that a physicist today would want to state the theorem. But it's just details, just, and there's things about the boundaries, right? It's just related to that.
Can you say a little bit about how the groups for your analogs of the Noether's theorem in the discrete case goes?
Oh, yeah, okay. The basic idea, and this is not a, there's some history to this. So I've suppressed a lot of references in this talk, so I encourage you to look at my paper to see the references. The rough idea is that if in a quantum field theory, if you have a global symmetry, then the operator, the thing that you're really interested in is there's a unitary operator on Hilbert space that implements the global symmetry. And so it's, if the symmetry is continuous, then it's the exponential of I times the charge. Times a coefficient, which you think of as a coordinate on the group. But if the group is discrete, it doesn't have that interpretation. You just have some unitary operators on the Hilbert space, and they're representing the group. And the ones that you think of as being the symmetry do the symmetry everywhere. That was our discussion about global symmetries. But you could nonetheless instead define a unitary operator which implements the symmetry only in some small region, and which does nothing outside of the region. And that's not going to be a symmetry, so it's not going to commute with the Hamiltonian, right? Because it's a global symmetry. It's not, if it were local symmetry, that would also be a symmetry. But if you do the symmetry here but not there, it's not a symmetry for a global symmetry. But it's still a thing you can do, and so you can define an operator which does that. And so in the continuous case, that would be like, defining a charge where you integrate J0 only over the region and not elsewhere. Okay, and again, that wouldn't be a conserved charge, but it would be something that implements the symmetry only in the region. But so these things with the unitary, I said, that makes sense for a discrete group too, and so you can organize the discussion around these unitaries that do the symmetry in a region instead of talking about the current. And that's good enough for the arguments that we want to make to work. Of course. Yeah, sure. Oh, that one. Yeah. Sorry.
I understand exactly how that was supposed to work.
Yeah. Okay. Good. So yeah, I was trying to. So I argued in the discussion of Noether's second theorem that functions of the fields which are not gauge invariant are not physical, because they're functions which you wouldn't be able to predict the dynamics of, you know. So if physics means we predict the dynamics of observables, then these had better not be observables. So the problem is that if you have a theory which has both a global symmetry and a local symmetry which is gauged, then Noether's theorem doesn't promise you that the Noether current for the global symmetry will be invariant under the local symmetry. And if it's not, then it's not physical. So it's still there as a function of the fields, but it's not there as a thing you can measure in the lab. So if you want, you know, and in particular, if you describe the theory, so since it's just a redundancy of description, you don't even need to talk about the gauge symmetry at all, right? So, you know, if you're trying to define quantum field theory abstractly the way a mathematician would, you wouldn't talk about the gauge symmetry at all because it's not part of the theory. And then this current just would not be there. You know, you just wouldn't see it. Like if I gave you a list of all the operators on the Hilbert space and the expectation values of, you know, and things like that, the Hamiltonian, you would just never see this current there. But what happens in these examples is even though there's no current, the charge is still there. So somehow you have a situation where the current is not gauge invariant, but if you integrate it over space to make a charge, then that ends up being gauge invariant, essentially because the gauge transformation of the current is a total derivative. And as we discussed, the boundary terms, the gauge transformations that you quotient by go to zero. And so that's why the charge is still allowed to be gauge invariant. So if you view Noether's theorem in this sort of, if you forget about the field theory part of Noether's theorem and you just view it as implying the existence of the charge, that version is still correct. But if you want to say, no, it's really there's a local current, well, in these examples, there isn't really. There's a fake local current, but it doesn't mean anything. And if you think about this example, I guess I should have written the current. I'm sorry, I didn't write the current, but you can see it's not gauge invariant. No, because it's not a subgroup. It's not a subgroup. Oh. It's two different symmetries. So yeah, let me be clear. Sorry. So the gauge group here, strictly speaking, is R times R because there's two gauge fields, and each one you can shift by epsilon, by d mu epsilon. Okay. That gauge symmetry does not mix the two A's together. Okay. My global symmetry rotates the two together. So the full sort of global symmetry group, if you also include the zero modes of the gauge symmetry, is U1 times R times R. Yeah. But somehow the R times R part pollutes the Noether current of the U1, even though the U1 is a totally kosher symmetry, global symmetry.
Yes. Sure.